Linda Burney leads well ahead there on first preferences, 49.1 with 62% of the vote. She can't be defeated from there with Green votes and the like. So that's a Labor Party. We're classing it as a retain because of the redistribution makes it look like a Labor seat. And we're saying that she will win that with 58% of the two-party preferred vote. And Nick Varvaris, the former member, has been defeated.
That's right. In all of the uncertainty of the evening, there is a little patch of certainty in the seat of Barton and some very happy faces there.
Annabel Crabb, and before her, Anthony Green, calling the historic victory of Linda Burney in the Sydney seat of Barton. The former New South Wales Minister and Deputy Leader of the Labor Party has made the transition to federal politics, unseating a Liberal MP in the electorate, which is now considered to be a marginal Labor seat, as you heard. Barton covers some parts of Sydney's inner west, like Marrickville, extending south to Rockdale, Alloa, Carlton and Hurstville. Linda Burney is a former teacher and bureaucrat. She grew up in a small town in the Riverina. When she moved to Sydney in the 1970s, politics might have seemed an unlikely path. But she went on to hold down some pretty tough portfolios when Labor was in government in New South Wales, including the poison chalice of community affairs. The first Aboriginal person to be elected to the New South Wales Parliament and the first Aboriginal woman to be elected to the lower house of federal parliament, Linda Burney has promised to bring grace and dignity to her new role as the member for Barton. And she's promised to call out racism when she sees it.
Well, it's a milestone, but thank you, Daniel. I'm very happy and excited to be here. I truly am.
And I attach much more importance to your election to the lower house than I did to Ken Wyatt's. And I don't really know why. A lot of people have been talking this one up. Why is it so momentous?
I think it's because I'm a woman and I'm an Aboriginal woman, and I have also had a fairly significant, not huge, but some sort of profile within the Aboriginal and the broader community. And I think a lot of people know me. You know, they've heard me speak. The work that I've done has been across a really wide range of areas. And I think also that with this election, it was such a high, you know, such a huge election in the sense it was so close. And I also challenged a sitting Liberal member. That's a pretty big thing to do.
What are you hoping that you can give your electors?
Well, I think the House of Representatives, as opposed to the Senate, both houses are incredibly important. And I'm very pleased that Australia has that system, because the Senate or the upper house is, you know, the House of Review, of course. But it's in the House of Representatives, it's in the lower house where government is formed. That's why there is so much focus on it. And the seat of Barton is an amazing place. You just fall in love with it.
What care that it doesn't say that, though?
Well, I know that, but you go there and I have to admit, I didn't know some of the suburbs well 3 months ago. But you go there, there's a massive Chinese community around Hurstville, huge Arabic community around Arncliffe, huge Greek community around Earlwood. The community that's growing the quickest in the electorate is the Nepalese community. And people are just so generous. You know, that's what I've really noticed, is that they have just been so generous to me. You know, it's a bit surprising if some new kids on the block, but most of the communities knew me through my work in Canterbury as the state member, because it's similar peak organisations for the various cultural groups. But people know that I, as an Aboriginal person, that's what really excited Barton. You know, they knew that we as an electorate had the opportunity on the 2nd of July to create history.
I don't know. I sometimes think, why do Aboriginal people, even career politicians like yourself, you didn't start out that way, but you certainly pursued a very long career in state politics and now federal politics. I sometimes think, I don't want people who, leaders in our community, to be blooded by politics. I felt this about Pat Dodson. Why would you seek to go there? A place that I think, you know, is full of compromise.
It's where the laws are made. That's what politicians do. That's why in America they're called lawmakers. And don't you think we should have a seat at the table where the laws of the land are made?
So you won't have to live in Canberra, you won't have to
move. No, I live in Marrickville within the seat of Barton, the redistributed part of Barton. And you spend at least, I would say, a quarter of a year, maybe a bit more, in Canberra, depending on what the parliamentary sitting schedule is, what your commitments are in terms of committees or other meetings. And I've got a girlfriend down there. If I said her name, you'd all know it. She's got a three-bedroom house, and I'm going to hang out at her house. We've travelled together before.
Couch surf?
No, it's a bedroom.
You're a bit more formal than that.
until I get to know the Canberra. But I've been given by another girlfriend the most gorgeous warm overcoat as a
You'll
gift.
You'll need it.
So I'll need it. But I think it's going to be a huge adventure. But I've always maintained that hubris is the enemy of politicians, and you don't get there on your own. I had amazing people. My campaign was led by Ed McDougall. Amazing people just working, putting their lives on hold for 2 months to volunteer and work with you to get you elected. And that requires a lot of reciprocity, and a huge thank you to those people.
What are the possibilities, say, with something like the constitutional recognition? The possibility of a referendum seems very far off, but what are the possibilities or the hopes for a bloc? I mean, I've got these dreams of a black bloc in Parliament, a cross-party black bloc, and it's fairly historic. The numbers are fairly historic.
I don't like the idea of a black bloc. But what I think will happen is that the Aboriginal members across various parties and independents will work really collaboratively on a number of issues that do have bipartisanship, and one of those is constitutional reform. You know, both major parties are committed to the constitutional referendum, as is most of the independents, including Xenophon, Jackie Lambie and the Greens. I think where the wild card might be is some of the new senators who include One Nation may not have that view. I don't know whether they do or they don't. But at the end of the day, the major parties are committed, and that's what's important. And to work along with the crossbench is also very important.
Are you surprised to see Pauline Hanson return to federal politics?
I am, but it would be instructive to know why people voted for One Nation and where most of those people are from. And I don't know the answers for that. There's been a lot of excuse-making going on, I hear, from some politicians about, you know, you've got to respect her and blah, blah, blah. But for me, you call out racism when you see it. And already we have seen her capacity to still hold some of the views she held 20 years ago. Still very prevalent. One very close to me in the sense that she criticised the suburb of Hurstville for being overrun by Asians. Now, Hurstville is in the electorate of Barton.
Your electorate?
That's correct. And, you know, she also made a statement that she's as Indigenous as any Aboriginal person. Well, that just points to ignorance, if not stupidity, to me. But, you know, she's a member of the Parliament, elected, and has a constituency. And therefore, you be courteous, you be respectful, you work through the issues, but you do not put up with unacceptable views and behaviour.
In government, you held some pretty tough portfolios.
I have.
What did that experience teach you?
Well, the toughest, of course, was community services here in New South Wales when Labor was in government. And that was really hard. I remember someone saying when I got the promotion to community services from, I think, Fair Trading, someone said, well, you know, congratulations on the promotion, shame about the job. But I loved community services. It sat well with me and I sat well with it, as tough as it was, because I could relate directly. I was raised by my great aunt and uncle. I wasn't raised by my immediate family. I understood, you know, the desire for people to know, for children that don't grow up with their family, to want to know where they came from. And at the end of the day, Daniel, I, as the minister, as hard as it was, read the files and made the tough decisions, but I didn't live the lives of children being starved and beaten and tortured. And, you know, you had to keep things in perspective. But what I'm really proud about is that we changed the culture of community services from being a culture of siege and into a culture of being proud of being a caseworker.
Aboriginal lives, I mean, you were dealing with Aboriginal lives, and there have been some critics who've said, well, you know, Linda Burney oversaw the removal of
That's right. Of
Aboriginal children from their families.
I did.
You know, on a case, were you going through, caseworkers obviously are doing this work. How much does the minister decide which children individually, and we're talking about large numbers of kids here, even though we're a small community, relatively, people have said, you know, children are being removed at a rate that compares with, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Mm. What do you say to those critics?
Well, the minister doesn't know about every child that's removed.
But the minister gets blamed.
But the minister does know about high-profile cases. Mm. And, of course, I took over the responsibility of community services after the two most high-profile deaths, which led to a special commission that was Dean Shillingsworth and the little girl that was known as Ebony, who was starved to death by her parents. Now, you know, you look at the child death review reports and you look at the recommendations and you decide what's going to go ahead and what's not. And out of the Justice James Woods Special Commission of Inquiry, you decided as minister at the end of the day, what was going to be pursued and what wasn't. I think we implemented 106 of the 111 recommendations. The position that I took is that the Aboriginal placement principle, that legislation that requires Aboriginal children removed to be placed with an Aboriginal family, was adhered to. It's not being adhered to anymore. The other thing is that you really promoted kinship care. And I think something like 84% of Aboriginal children removed from their immediate family were in kinship care under my watch.
To their extended family.
To their extended family. They're the things you can do. But I also took the position that if a child's life was in danger, I didn't look at whether they were Aboriginal
kinship care
or not.
Might be the last thing you should do.
It was if a child's life was being compromised and in danger, determined by the courts that was the case, then that child was removed, whoever they were.
Leeton is home?
No, Leeton is where I was born.
Yeah.
The little township outside of Leeton, and it is little, called Witten was where I grew up, and that was a township of about 200 people.
And it was two aunties who raised you?
No, my great-aunt and my great-uncle, who were non-Aboriginal. Mm. They were brother and sister and they never married and they were in their extraordinary, brave people. They would have been born, this will freak some of your younger listeners out, they would have been born in the late 1890s. And they were in their probably mid to late 60s when they took me on. Now imagine that in a small country town in the late 50s, a couple of old white people taking on a little black kid, baby. Amazing.
But you were blood.
Oh, yeah. They were my mother's aunt and uncle. Mm.
So did you rebel? Did you tear away from them?
I've heard
you talk about them before.
Yeah, no, I didn't. What was interesting is that the roles were kind of reversed because they were healthy and fit and able to look after me until they became too old and too feeble and I became their carer at the age of 13 or 14, 15. When I say carer, I mean, you know, I was the one that
was looking after them
and I don't know that I did a great job. I did my best. And they died when I was about 14 and 15 and then I lived with my friend's parents' family for 12 months to finish year 10 and then I moved to the Big Smoke, and lived with my natural mother, whom I'd never lived with before, and my stepfather, which was for a couple of years.
And that's when you moved to Sydney, right? That's the time you moved to Sydney.
That's right, yeah.
And, you know, many, many years ago, I think you worked with my auntie, who was an Aboriginal teacher up on the far north coast of New South Wales, Marcia Browning.
I certainly did. Yeah, well, so she was a trailblazer way back and beautiful.
But education was where in the same way that you see politics as or the law, lawmaking as where we need to be, at that time you felt that education was the place.
Well, I still do. I mean, education is, you know, the great equaliser. It doesn't happen overnight, but if you really want to change the condition, if you like, of Aboriginal people in this country, in my world, education is the key, but it's generational.
So education, I mean, Bill Shorten is assembling, we assume, is in the process of assembling his new front bench. What aspirations or hopes do you have to join him on the front bench?
My aspiration is to be the best representative for the people of Barton, to be a really active and considered contributor to the policy process. And, you know, you'd expect me to say this, I know, but I truly just want to be a good politician and learn about being a federal politician.
If Bill Shorten said to you, I want you on the front bench and I want your portfolio responsibility to be your opposition spokesperson on Indigenous affairs, what would you... I mean, you must be canvassing these options in your head.
Well, I think we should just wait and see what happens. I think the best thing is to wait and see how... I mean, I've been a member of Parliament for a long time. I know not to preempt anything. And I would be delighted to serve, and service is what I've done my entire life, and I'll continue to do that.
The first Aboriginal woman to be elected to the Federal House of Representatives, that's Linda Burney, the new member for the Sydney seat of Barton. This is Away, you're on RN with me, Daniel Browning.